Welcome to The Process Podcast, an interview series focused on the process of survival as a creative. Season 6 features conversations with visual artists and curators and gallerists from the Bay Area of California. These conversations took place during a 3-month-long residency at the Growlery, an incredible organization based in San Francisco, who facilitated many of these conversations. They can be found at thegrowlery.org. We have also launched a Patreon for those who want to and are able to provide some financial support for the show to help us keep going. You can learn more about why we've launched that and where the money goes and how it will help us grow at patreon.com/theprocessco. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we hope you dig the season. Cheers, y'all.
Hello from LA, although going back to Brooklyn tomorrow. Super stoked to share this episode with you. It's a conversation with the artist Joshua Rampage, who is a multimedia artist living in San Francisco, California, currently focused on his painting career. He produces work that aims to encourage inclusivity in an insular world with a specific ideal to promote and sustain curiosity. He's been working on a series called Secret for over 10 years, where he paints people's secrets within a painting, completely hidden by overlaying brushstrokes. I've seen them. They are super beautiful. His color combination is just stunning. And I think in this episode you'll hear us talk about the fact that he is colorblind, but yet somehow makes these amazing combinations that just work so, so well. He's also a musician who's been a couple of well-known touring bands before shifting his focus to the visual arts. In this conversation, we talked about having multiple interests as a part of your art practice, but also on the flip side, the importance of focusing and finishing your work when you do pick one to work on at a time, the value of having levity through life, shifting his focus from music to painting, his time spent in Australia, his relationship to San Francisco. We also talk about finding humor in whatever you can, how purpose is his driver, and a whole lot more. I really enjoyed this conversation. I hope you do too. You can find show notes with what we talk about and links to Joshua's website and Instagram over at theprocess.co. Hope you dig it, and we'll catch you next week. Cheers, y'all.
My name is Joshua Rampage. I'm an artist living in San Francisco, California.
What type of art do you do?
Mainly focus on visual art, but I really appreciate the idea of having several different practices and seeing how they can all counter-inform each other. Have you ever heard of this idea? It's called Gesamtkunstwerk.
No.
It's like this old theory. It's German. That's why the work, but it's just work, you know. Essentially, that's translated into total body or complete artwork. It kind of refuses to have like any kind of English translation. That's kind of neat. But it started with these architects who weren't satisfied in only building the structure. They wanted to have a say in the landscape and the interiors down to a T, where the paintings go, what the flatware looks like, what the sconces look like. And it's pretty ambitious and a little rigid. I like the idea to appropriate it to saying, you know, it's almost more beneficial not to just paint. You should be drawing too. You should be writing things down. Kind of if you play music, you know, pick up an instrument, see what that sounds like. Because I just really believe that these things all counter-inform each other, and whatever you end up with ends up kind of being the result of this, of that kind of practice. It's all gonna kind of look like or sound like you, and that is kind of the ideal, right? I mean, even when artists move between series, etc., when you place them all together, doesn't have to necessarily be in like a retrospective or anything, but I think you start to see a consistency or like a continuity in just the breadth of the work.
Do you feel like by doing all these different things, it kind of also helps you refine who it is you are and like what your unique style is?
I think you're always learning. Yeah. You're always discovering things. You make an inadvertent mistake, and all of a sudden that leads you down this other rabbit hole that you would have never arrived at had you not been kind of farting around with something else that you wouldn't have in quote-unquote main practice. If you're just kind of monomaniacally painting or something like that, I think there's a lot of possibility in variation.
Do you tend to kind of focus on everything a little bit at once or one thing at a time?
I think that is important to do. You know, you really shouldn't be going, or subjectively speaking, I don't really go run up to the painting, make a mark, and then pick up the pencil and then make a mark and then play a G chord on the guitar.
Right.
I think focus is really important. Focusing and finishing work. there is this thing that I know I've heard a lot of other artists slip into where, you know, nothing, like, finishing things is a big hurdle. And whether or not that plays into the psychology of it all, like, oh God, it's finished and now this is the finished product and this is what's going to go before everybody. There's a certain nervousness in that. Mm-hmm. I think you should own it. You should be as confident as you possibly can in the product that you've created, and you'll make more.
For you personally, how do you know, like with a painting, for example, how do you know that it's finished?
That's a good question. That's been a question that I've been asked consistently throughout, especially the series, because I think at any given moment it could quote unquote be done.
Right.
It is just this really subconscious feeling. You just know. And I've also started to really try to practice, you know, when you're in your studio, you don't always have to be making marks. You don't always have to be moving paint around or quote unquote, you know, doing work all the time. It's important to, I think, grow comfortable in just being there and looking at things and thinking about them and allowing them to, like, reveal themselves to you and let you know whether or not it's finished or not.
I think that's one reason I'm drawn to photography, because there is, when it's taken, it's, like, finished, because I'm someone who's, like, really bad at finishing things. I have projects that, like, are still open to the world that I'm not really doing anything with it, definitely. I have trouble ending things, I guess, more than finishing, though.
I guess it's, like, maybe it's in the turn of phrase there, you know, it's finished feels more, there's like a strength in being like, that's finished,
right?
Versus is it over, it's ending. That feels like a finality. In a finality, there's not a lot of room to, there's not a lot of openness in it.
Right.
And I think it's important to stay open as much as you possibly can.
Yeah, totally. So tell me a bit more about the series you're currently working on, The Secrets.
So this series I've been doing for about 10 years, give or take. And
speaking of not being over.
Yeah, yeah. And before I go off on that tangent, on what the paintings are about, I think as long as you're doing something and it's still invigorating you, it's still making you happy, it's still keeping you curious, as long as you still think there's possibility in it, you should pursue that. Do not leave that. Yeah, I think I'll know when it's time to step away or something, but I think there's such myriad in the series because they are based on secrets, literally. I always loved using text in my work. I went to school for graphic design, and typography was one of my favorite aspects of it. It's communication, you know, it's more than just shapes as a visual language. It's quite literally communication, you know, the written word, the Western English character, as it were. And I was using a lot of text. I was such a big fan of Cy Twombly and Jean-Michel Basquiat, and I just loved that, you know, there's always something that you're discovering more and more. I never read that part, or especially in the really dense works. Not so much with Twombly, because he was pretty airy with all his stuff. I loved kind of continuing with that in mind, and so I had all this text in my painting. And I had a friend at the time who was also a painter and living in San Francisco. This was like the late 2000s. And we would have these kind of dialogues about the benefits and the detriment to having something so finite as text in your work. Once it's written down and read, sure, you can take that however you feel like taking it. It still feels permanent and finite. That was always something that we had trouble with, how to grapple with that. Because when you're making work, it's kind of a high ideal to make it infinite. You know, you want to make something you can return to over and over and over again. It was kind of like a little silly studio mistake, I guess. I had written down a bunch of things, and I inadvertently went over some stuff. And it was kind of like a light bulb moment. It was like, all right, what now? Where can we go with this, and what does this mean? I started thinking, there's always been that, there's a word called palimpsest, which means you write something and then you erase it, and then you write something and you erase it, and it's just, and you can kind of see the evidence over and over and over again. That definitely word reminds me of Cy Twombly's work, mm-hmm. for sure. You know, Jean-Michel used to write something and cross it off, and, you know, sometimes you would be able to read what it was, and sometimes there's just something about that you want to know. Kind of started thinking about, yeah, what don't we know? Like, what are those things that we're endlessly curious about? It's like secrets. Secrets are great because, one, everybody knows what a secret is, and two, everybody's got them.
Yeah.
And so I really started thinking about what secrets were, you know, because they're just intrinsically interwoven into the fabric of society. I mean, they're everywhere when you really scratch the surface, you know, when you really start to think about that. And so I thought about what secrets meant to me. And I had remembered this time when I was really young and I'd inadvertently revealed a secret that I didn't realize wasn't quote unquote common knowledge. And I got in trouble for it. And I kind of learned a pretty good lesson about when someone tells you a secret, whether or not they preface it by saying, you know, this is a secret, don't tell anybody. Because what's the first instinct when someone tells you that? You gotta run out, tell the world. I think that's in direct contrast to integrity. When someone tells you a secret, they find trust in you, they feel comfortable, they feel like they can be candid and tell you, they can open themselves up to you. And I think we should do well to recognize when that's happening and also have integrity about it. You know, this kind of just snowballed into like, wow, what are the possibilities of that? And I just started remembering all these secrets that I had, and I started writing them into the paintings. And
secrets other people had told you or your own?
Other people's. It was kind of very important, because this goes another little side tangent. I think, personally speaking, the work that I've always made, it's very necessary for other people to exist. I think if I was the only person living on the planet, I wouldn't make work. Right. Like, what's the point? I mean, because one of my big points is to share with other people, to hopefully get across to them, to make something that resonates. Or if it doesn't resonate, gets them to think why it doesn't. Just to kind of create a dialogue or something further than what you created in the first place. So yeah, it was very important that it was other people's secrets. I did a sub-series for Caroline's Ab Reaction show, and those were all autobiographical, and they were all about ex-lovers. And so that was one circumstance where they were mine. But for the most part, I think, yeah, it's very important to have them be other people's, because in a way, by making these paintings, they're very much a purging exercise for me. To that extent, you know, I write it down, and I'm spending all this time with it, but it kind of stops being a secret, becomes something else entirely. It's a different object now.
Yeah.
And also in that process, I love when people are like, so what secret's in this one?
Yeah.
And you're like, I can't tell you that because it's a secret.
Do you tell the people, the holder of the secret or the giver of the secret, do you tell them that their work is, or that their secret is in your work?
Totally.
Okay.
Totally.
Do they ask to see it online?
I like to let people know when one of theirs made
it
in.
That's fair.
Yeah, absolutely. And with some commission work I've been doing, I've started to suggest or ask if they, yes, I'll make you a secret painting, but do you have a secret that you want to put on it, to make it even more personal? They know what's in it. They own it. But also, the way I write it, sometimes it gets truncated or abridged, and so there's still this mystery to it.
I wonder, I forget if I told you this last time we chatted, but my best friend back home is pregnant. And she's still, like, not, I still shouldn't be telling people, she's still, like, not that far along, and she really wasn't when she told me, so I was not supposed to tell anybody. Mm-hmm. It's fucking killing me, especially to not tell our other best friend, which I did not do, but I had to tell someone. I told my friend Pete, who, like, she would never care that I told him, but I just had to get the words out of my mouth, and also, like, because I was excited. I was like, it was like a happy thing, right? I wonder if I wrote it down or like put it in a painting, if that would have done the same thing. I think I still would have had to tell someone.
You'd be surprised. Yeah. Or at least I've grown comfortable. That's my way of purging it, you know, instead of trying to go up against that desire, that very natural, like, I just have to tell somebody.
It took me like 2 weeks to tell our other friend. I'm like, I'm going to kill you.
Yeah.
You have to tell her.
And I want to note what you said, you know, that's a happy secret.
Right.
And another reason why I'm continuing these paintings and really trying to dig into this concept is I think secrets get a bad rap. Everyone thinks if it's a secret, it's something bad or like dark or sinister. And I don't think that's totally true. There are secrets where people are totally in love with someone, but they would never say it.
Right.
They, you know.
But that could, in their eyes, sorry to cut you off, but potentially be like, catastrophic, that's hyperbolic, but catastrophic if the other person found out for whatever reason.
So there is still
dating their best friend or brother or sister or whatever, you know? Yeah.
Totally.
Sorry.
So there is, I mean, I guess at the end of the day, there is this very much like, you know, if you pull the curtain back far enough, things will be revealed, and I guess it's whether or not you can A, handle it, if you want to know it, if, there's a lot of big ifs, but I'm a pretty curious person, and there's so much that I would like to know. Like, it kind of drives me crazy, you know, like, say, like, UFOs, like, the general consensus is, like, you know, they figure, like, the population wouldn't be able to handle the truth of it all. And it's right. Like, God damn it, tell us already. Like, yeah. Tell us what you know. I want to know.
Yeah.
That's also the other thing. It's kind of, it feels very finite once you know.
Right. And if we know that we're using that example, then there wouldn't be conspiracy theories.
Right.
And other things that are just so much fun.
To riff off of. Yeah. Absolutely. Speculate.
Yeah. People love to speculate.
Exactly. Exactly. It's a great exercise because it gets the brain turning.
Yeah. Because it's a good way of making up stories, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you know the truth, what does that then open up?
Well, that's the very thing. It's like, you know, the biggest secret of all. What's the meaning of life? What are we doing here? What is this all about? In a way, it's like, yeah, if that was revealed to you, would you just, like, would it just cease to exist? Because there's not that mystery to it. And I think that's a lot of what keeps us going. What could be next? In an exciting way, not in a fearful way. Okay. Like, what's next? We should try to be excited and hopeful about what is next.
Yeah.
As opposed to getting too cynical about it.
Totally. Yeah, that's something that I feel like it's a constant exercise. Totally. So this body of work, I was looking at your website again, it's pretty different than a lot of your past work.
I was just talking to someone last night about this. She was telling me she was asked by a friend of hers who's been making work for decades. And his website was like, it spans 1986 to like 2018.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of asked her to kind of clean it up, like, what do you do? And she found herself getting lost in just the breadth of the work. And it was a nice, you know, memory lane stroll. But at the same time, it's exactly what she said. She got lost in it. And there is a certain amount, especially in contemporary society, where everything's kind of like, any news reports are broken down into sentences. It's not even, people don't even read paragraphs anymore. I think if you present something that is too much to take in, people will, you know, get bored too quickly or just get distracted or any reason that would detract them from kind of really experiencing what they're seeing. So to that extent, like I on my website, I only have work from kind of, you know, back from a couple years, maybe 3 years. I suppose if I had it all there, it would be beneficial to see a progression, but at the same time, I think it's important to show what you're making as contemporarily as possible. And I would say they by default, you know, things evolve and change. And I think every artist has it in them, this really big fear. They don't want to make the same thing over and over and over again, regardless if it's selling, whatever. It's stifling to your natural creativity and desire to push things. And I really started to think a lot about how much I'd learned to speak on the series and talk about it. And I felt if I could talk about it in a myriad that I should also be able to execute it visually, kind of push the retinal experience, as it were. And in the past 2-3 years, just really tried to start breaking all the rules that I'd kind of created, all the parameters that I'd set up in creating these. And how can I do this different? I started, like, you know, tucking them in instead of going, you know, writing from edge to edge straight up. It was kind of just scooting them in a little bit, using the frame of the canvas to create a parameter, but also have a border within it. And just really looking back at art history, looking contemporarily, what you really love people are doing, what you don't think really works. I mean, it's just really trying to find that aesthetic that resonates with you and then execute that. I mean, steal from everywhere, put it in your brain blender, put it on high and see what comes out. I mean, one thing that's always frustrated me with creativity, whether it's literature or music or film or visual artwork, is when artists are riffing maybe a little bit too obviously. When you see it, you know exactly who they're big influences were. If I learned one thing in art school or throughout the course of making art, is it's really important to be as original as you think you can be. Or that's the thing that makes me excited. Whether or not that is a viable way to go about it, because when you really look at the history of things, and especially in contemporary society, with film, with music, with art. There's a lot of people creating things that riff off what was very popular before. Say it was 10 years ago, say it was 20 years ago, and they're just kind of rebooting it. Yeah. And I think that's, personally, I just always felt that was kind of fucking boring.
Dude, I went and saw a movie, I think it was on Christmas Day, and all of every single trailer was redoing something that's been done 1,000 times, or like a clear ripoff. And I was like visibly pissed. My friend was like, calm down. I was like, what the fuck?
It really gets me so upset. Yeah, I'm just like, you know,
our society is boring.
And so boring. There's no creativity. And it's also unfortunate because it panders to this, we're not going to make you think too hard.
Yeah.
Okay, you know this, you're familiar with this. Here's the new version, yeah, with some new actors or some new notes or some different colors in, but right, more or less you're seeing or experiencing the same thing. And I've never been a big fan of that. I get so excited when I come across something that just I've never seen or heard or read before. It is a tangible, visceral experience to experience something. You're like, wow, people are still making something new. I love that shit.
Yeah, same. How do you strike that balance between being inspired by past work and people you respect and staying original? Like you mentioned, steal from everywhere, put in the brain blender. What does that brain blender process look like? Have you ever like painted something and then be like, fuck, that looks a lot like so-and-so's work? Or like, how do you prevent that from happening?
That's interesting. I think maybe because I am trying to consider that in my head so much before. I'm not a very big fan of doing studies or sketches because I have a lot of time where I'm not working to formulate in my brain what's going to happen. So I think because you're constantly formulating without actually doing the work, that you are preventing yourself from inadvertently making something that is too familiar or letting that slip. But then at the same time, I mean, the group of paintings I made for my solo show, I really was looking back to people that really influenced me a lot. Mark Rothko in particular, a couple pieces. And I knew, I was just like, yeah, these are very Rothko. And then a couple people came in and were like, oh, Rothko-ish, yeah. And I'm like, but it felt comfortable for some reason because I still felt like I was owning my idea enough, but I was still lifting what he was doing, but it's still just so different.
Yeah. At Minnesota Street Project, I saw a painting of a Rothko book.
Yes. Yep. That little book painting series. I love that stuff.
To, like, play homage, I guess.
Absolutely. And that's what it is about. I mean, when it is about nodding in a big appreciative way to what came before you and being like, my God, I love you. I would have never had the foresight or the idea to do this before I experienced what you taught me.
Yeah. And you can do that and still make it different or make your other work different. So I also noticed with your past work, things are much more like controlled. They're much more real, like with the orbs.
Mm.
It's very like organized, right?
Yeah.
Like, to the eye. Or like the firearms thing is a like, realistic.
Right? Really, really yeah. Illustration. Yeah. That goes back to, you know, having several different mediums and practices. When I'm painting, for example, it feels very athletic. I'm standing up before a large canvas and moving in ways that I wouldn't move in any other situation except for painting. And then in contrast, you know, when you're sitting down at a drafting table and you're using a 0.05 micron pen to kind of render these old men with their utilitarian guns to go hunting or something, you can't have too much coffee before that. You really have to just like kind of calm yourself down to a certain extent. And the same kind of goes for the sea orbs. There's this fluidity to it, but there still is this other practice. I mean, it's not the same as moving around pigment with a brush or scraping with a palette knife. It's just different mark making, and you find your brain is adapting kind of a different personality to approach those things. You know, I'm in a totally different mindset when I'm making a mixtape or something like that, right, or writing, whether it's typing or handwriting, everything. I think if you really start considering what you're doing when you're doing it, you'll find these discrepancies in them. But then also I've found that I'll take that kind of more calm approach that I would do with a like a rendered drawing, and I will take that calmness and I'll try to bring that to the painting, and I'll work for moments like that and see if that works, and then I'll try to do some drawings that maybe are a little bit more active and alive and free than the structured production of using your hand as a mini sewing machine to do the pointillism.
Taking kind of like a giant step back, can you talk a bit about your history in music? What made you kind of depart from that and venture into visual art?
Sure. I started playing music pretty late in the game in terms of musicians. I mean, a lot of musicians that I played with in bands over the years had all gotten guitars for Christmas or whatever, like when they were 12, junior high, beginning of high school, and they started their little garage bands and stuff like that. And I basically started playing my first year in college. One of my best friends, he was one of the first people I met when I went to school, and he lived across the hall from me, and he played everything. He'd been playing in bands since he was like 12, and he just was so encouraging of me to learn, and I wanted to learn, and I felt like I got a very serious crash course. I mean, he gave me a guitar to just have in my room, and I'd have to keep asking him to borrow it. And I think that was very important for the foundation of just really learning, because I'd always listened to music growing up in the mom's minivan, 80s pop, and then start getting into some like the golden age of hip hop. Like rap was like one of my first genres that I liked out of my own volition. You know, it wasn't your mom picking the station. Like I remember buying Ghostbusters 2 soundtrack on tape cassette, and it had like Run DMC and Bobby Brown and Dougie Fresh and the Get Fresh crew. And there was something about it that I don't know why it really resonated with me. I really just loved the production, like the rhythmic nature of it all, the MCs and their cadences and the timbre of their voice. And there was something just really, it made me kind of like move in a way that I wouldn't have if I hadn't heard this music before. Music, it was so important growing up, and then, you know, I think it plays a huge part of your identity, especially in junior high and high school, and then moving forward to college, and what are you listening to, tell me what you got. And this is pre-internet, you know, before streaming, and where things are kind of curated for you at this point. I mean, a lot of finding music was predicated upon who you were friends with and what they were listening to and whether they would share it with you or not. But I really got into that idea where that's why I love just finding as much and learning so much about it, so I could tell my friends about this band, they could tell me about this, and you know, it just becomes very reciprocal. Yeah, music in general was really important, and I couldn't probably say what artist or album or song it was that I was like, I kind of want to do this. But it was somewhere probably in my senior year of high school. I was like, man, I kind of want to like write some songs. I think I can do that. You know, I mean, where these things occur to us, you just kind of never know. But it did. And so it was really profound, and I felt very drawn to it. So yeah, just started trying to learn as fast to make up for lost time that everyone else seemed to already have, and started playing with people that were just by default better because they've been playing longer, and was learning so much very quickly because, you know, they're trying to push you because they don't want you to be the weak link, and you want to learn as much as you can from them. And, you know, you start playing guitar, and then someone's like a piano player, and they're like, well, let me show you just how this works. And then someone's a drummer, and they're like, all right, this is how this works, and bass. And, you know, you just start experimenting with as much as you can. I try to always have a very open mind. I wasn't like, oh, drum machines aren't my thing or whatever. It's just like, sure, how do you work this thing? Mm-hmm. How can I get a sound out of it? And not being afraid of what sounds you would produce. I feel good about not being classically trained in music. I think when you become classically trained in anything, the rules that you were taught might prevent you from breaking them. It becomes too logically bound, too linear. You're just like, well, that just can't happen. You can't put those two chords together. And I never liked that idea. I was like, you can do whatever you want. And it was solidified by Don Van Vliet. Have you ever heard of Captain Beefheart?
Oh, of course.
He's one of my favorites of all time, and he's a fantastic painter. If you've never seen any of his work, is just soak it up. He's an amazing painter, and he always considered himself more of a painter than a musician. Which is crazy because he made one of the most esoteric original records, Trout Mask Replica, even though that is not one of my favorites of his. I think it's very important that it sits in the history of music and has influenced, you know, countless of still my favorite artists coming up, or stuff that's been in the past, but he was a big proponent of just saying, you know, if you approach it and if you are so inclined, you should do it. And don't, it's kind of like whatever art teacher told me, don't ever doubt your line. You can't make a fucking mistake. There are no mistakes. It's just whether or not you want to qualify it as a mistake. And that really kind of invigorated the music practice. So I felt like I really cut my teeth in college, played in a couple bands. And then at the very end, I played with my roommate's band and they were on like a label. And, you know, we got to play shows in like different towns. He had me playing just a bunch of different stuff. I played, like I had this little auxiliary setup where I had like a stereo that had a record player on top and I'd have that going. And I had like a trumpet and a trombone and a guitar, and I played a log, like there was a log with some sticks, and just all these little like sound things to kind of just create a bigger sound for what they were doing, which was kind of psychedelic singer-songwriter stuff. But it was terribly fun, and also gave me the idea. It's just like, wow, I mean, these guys got on a label, like, we can do this, you know, like this is possible, you know. It just reminds you that things are possible. And so I took that and ran with it and just started to really refine what I loved and what was being made at the time and how I wanted to join that group of history and leave my mark on it. So was playing in a band in Chicago after college, and we kind of felt like our sound wasn't really fitting in Chicago. Not that any city has a quote-unquote sound, but admittedly, there are schools in every city, whether it's visual work, music, etc., you know, like...
Chicago's very, like, punk, isn't it?
Yeah, it's, like, punk, and it's, like, alternative, alternative, I yeah. guess would be the, and, like, for the word.
I think of, like, Riley Walker, like, the jam, yeah. more, like, psyche jammy kind
sure,
of.
Sure, yeah. sure, sure. And we kind of just came to the conclusion, like, all right, I don't know if this is the spot for us. Like, we have to pick a coast and go to that. And it was kind of like, we didn't really want to go to New York. And so it was the West Coast. And it was like, all right, LA or San Francisco. And San Francisco had this label called Anti-Con, which was this label that was kind of doing this avant-garde hip-hop. It was kind of like a lot of white dudes that were from the Midwest, actually, that had moved out, you know, 5 years previous to that. And they were, I mean, they were hip-hop, but it wasn't. It was just such a melting pot of a sound. Like, it just felt like it was picking from so many different genres, but still had this, like, very... a lot of hip-hop sensibilities to it. Not that we were necessarily doing that, but it felt like the right place. It's like, all right, let's go to the Bay Area, like let's go there. And I mean, San Francisco is steeped in music history in terms of bands that have always kind of trying to like do something just a little bit more far out and see if people will follow it. So all moved out here as a band, made it about 3 months, and then we broke up.
What was this band called?
That band was called Libidinous Clones. Pretty pretentious, yeah. And ridiculous. You can leave that out if you want. But so yeah, you broke up and just felt like completely untethered, because I mean we had just moved here, didn't really know a lot of people, and I felt like it was basically starting anew. And so I spent endless hours on Craigslist, just on the musician's page, being like, all right, your little description sounds like maybe we'll have some things to talk about. I was just meeting up with people every week, just trying to find people to start a project with while still writing songs by myself. And I came across this one post by this guy, and it was just, it felt like I had written it in this totally other way, but it just really resonated with me. And I just, at that point, I mean, it had been like 2 or 3 months of just sitting on there and not feeling like I was meeting just the right people to do stuff with. And I wrote him, and he wrote me back immediately with just like an even more extravagant reply, and we met up, and we were just instantly fast friends. And that was like the beginning of starting the last band I played in. He was playing in a project, another project that was pretty full-time, but we were getting together pretty regularly to work on stuff, and we were starting to come up with these songs, and we were like, man, these are pretty cool, but we're not going to be, we were like, well, let's just have a two-person band, and we'll make it happen. But then we kind of started realizing these compositions were going to require more people. And so I went back on Craigslist, and, you know, you're starting to meet more people. It's, you know, I've been in San Francisco for maybe almost a year, and started, I don't know, pretty much poaching people from other bands, just trying to put together like the Ocean's 11 crew or something. You know, yeah. Everyone has their like really awesome things that they do, and together you can kind of just make something even more cool with that. And yeah, so we worked so hard on, we basically wanted to do it in reverse. We didn't want to start just playing out the four songs we had written. We wanted to write pretty much a full-length album before we even played our first show. So you're not trying to continuously play shows, but we'll try to write new songs at the same time when you're still just kind of starting. So we spent about a year just writing and dialing things in. And then by the time we had done that, we kind of had our crew, we had really solid songs, and with having called people from different bands and that were already in the San Francisco music community, we found ourselves like in a really great position where we had a solid audience and certain connections that maybe you wouldn't have if you rushed it a little bit more. So kind of from our first show, it was just really, we were all felt really lucky in terms of how it went. And it was just kind of, it was one of the first projects, if not the first thing that I'd done in my life where I really felt a tangible result with how hard we had been working on it. Myself and Jason had been pouring ourselves into it, and everyone else had as well. There were so many things I didn't do, like, come to this party, let's go out tonight, let's do this. Like, no, we're writing in Jason's bedroom, just drinking tall boys and smoking a little dope, but really just working and writing and starting to try to get your word out, send out your CD. I was making these little CDRs that had this little, like, I don't want to call it a logo, but handwriting, like the drawing and the sleeves, and just making it a little bit more personal, because this was like 2008, 2007, 2008. Just trying to, make it special. Just make it as special as you can. And I was telling a friend this last night too, like we must have gone through 50 different names for the band. And finally Jason and I are talking. He's like, well, Caitlin, his girlfriend, he's like, she had an idea. What about Mouse House? Because, you know, at the end of the day, a band name is just a placeholder. It's just got to be so simple and stupid that people just can not forget it. Like, it's almost impossible not to, you know. Because it's those esoteric ones where it's these made-up words and stuff. You're like, I can't even pronounce that, let alone remember it. And then that makes you feel, at least personally speaking, it makes me feel funny. Like, I don't know, there's this, like, reservation to maybe not be as into it or something. Maybe that sounds shitty. But either way, I was like, well, if we use a German spelling, I'm, like, into that. And so it just stuck. And Mouse House just kind of rolled off the tongue. Like, everyone seemed to, like, remember it. And yeah, we just started really doing it in earnest. I mean, it was a little difficult because half of us had full-time jobs and half of us had kind of like a little bit more gigging jobs, so they were a little bit more free. So touring always kind of was dependent on who could get PTO and dialing everything in. But Jason was just invaluable in terms of just somehow knowing how to, like, bring everything together. Such a taskmaster, and just had this vision that could make it work. And so, yeah, we made our first LP. We're touring the West Coast pretty consistently. Went on a couple Midwest and East Coast tours. Played some really great shows. Played Noise Pop a couple years in a row. Went down to South by Southwest. That's where I met Caroline and her band at the time, Splinters. I mean, it was everything I'd ever wanted from music and where I felt like I was heading with in life. And I was also painting at the same time, but that was only getting so much attention. It was more like really using it as one of those counterpoints. I mean, if we didn't have practice one day, or if the songs weren't coming, if the lyrics weren't really coming along or something, feeling frustrated, go paint and then see what you can bring back from that exchange. And I was that's when I really started feeling like that was an important part of my process. Yeah, I guess about like 5 years into it, in a real talk kind of way, it started to become its own animal. I mean, and it always was. It wasn't just Jason's project. It wasn't just my project. It wasn't Joe or Aaron or Sean's. It was everybody's. But I think there's a fine line to walk in creativity when you make it too democratic. That was kind of the direction it was going, you know, to be as quote-unquote democracy is supposed to be fair.
Yeah.
But at the same time, when you start voting on whether or not this little sample goes into the song and, like, two people are like, I don't like it, and then three people are like, well, it's fine. It feels like you're compromising. And when you compromise with art, sometimes it doesn't feel as potent as it could be. Because one thing I don't think a lot of people know is a lot of successful bands, they have like a definitive songwriter. A person's being like, this is how it's going to be, y'all. Get on board or get the fuck out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a reality, because you kind of can't take everyone's opinion and consideration into consideration, because it just gets too messy and too much to keep track of and it takes too long. And yeah, I always wanted to be very pragmatic about things and efficient And it just started to feel like it was becoming more difficult for me to feel like it was what it had been. And I think that goes with everything. Yeah. Because bands are very much like a relationship as well. Mm-hmm. And honeymoon period was definitely way over. But you're still riding like this level of success and you want to keep it going. But then you're kind of realizing what you're missing out on the side, because you are really working so hard and you're not going out to those parties or birthdays or going out to the bar or whatever. And
5 years is a long time to...
Yeah, just to be grinding, and along with a full-time job and a full-time girlfriend. Right. And it just, you know, it came to a point where I had maybe 30 minutes of where I was by myself any given day. And I'm kind of a person that needs to kind of go away from everything and kind of recharge and recalibrate and feel like then I can return to the group or to any social aspect with like renewed and refreshed and not just feel like I'd been talking or listen to people talk to me constantly. Yeah, it just, you just start to feel kind of exhausted. You know, I don't think it was like I woke up one day and just felt like it, but it was just, I think I remember thinking, yeah, it's just not as fun as I remember it being. And if something just stops being fun or like the thing to do, you kind of have to be an adult and be mature and take yourself out of it.
It goes back to realizing when something's like finished, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that, I mean, the finality of it all is a little, it's always a little heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But you also have to do what's important to you. Mm-hmm. And so
you're not really doing them a service if you're not like,
if you're not fully there, you're not fully present, you're not happy. You're not really bringing everything that you should be bringing to the table in that context.
Right.
I abdicated, said, gentlemen, you know, here's my chair. Like it, cause it's not, you know, it's no one's project, you know, it was never like the band has to break up just because someone is choosing to go do something else. And I was very specific about that. So yeah, I abdicated from my band, and then a couple months later abdicated from the woman I had been in a serious relationship with for a long time. And for the first time in 3 years, I didn't have to ask permission to use the bathroom. At least that's what it felt like. And it felt extraordinarily liberating and free, and I'd always wanted to live abroad, and so I ended up moving to Australia.
Right, and you had a residency there.
I had an artist in residency, fell into that cosmically. I'd been there for about 3 months, feeling all the new dirt underneath my feet, but also felt like I went there not to just fart around, and I don't know, I wasn't going there as a backpacker or anything like that. I really wanted to just live in the cities and kind of just see what they were up to. I'm very fascinated with like sociology and just why people do what they do when they do it. And so I felt like I could just, you know, I could make paintings or drawings and maybe play some music casually down there, but just kind of do what I was doing here, but do it in a different country on the other side of the world. Yeah. It sounded like an interesting opportunity. But I'd been there for like 3 months and I was just not really feeling like I was getting to it like I wanted to. And I was sitting one day, we were watching an Australian rules football game, local one, and just having some VB beers, and I started talking to this girl, this new friend of mine, and she, this girl Heather, and she's like, oh yeah, my aunt, she has a studio space, and she's opening a gallery, maybe you should talk to her. And I was like, yeah, that sounds great. And I ended up going over there and meeting up with this woman, Carmel Byrne, you guys share her last name, and we just hit it off immediately. She was so inviting and welcoming, and we were just prattling on like schoolgirls. Just had everything in the world to talk about it. And at the end of our 3 hour sit down initially, she's like, how about if you take a studio here? And, you know, and I was like, I don't really have a lot of money. And she's like, we'll figure that all out. How about you help me do stuff. We'll get the gallery up going, like, and we'll call it an even trade. I was like, this is awesome. Hell yeah. And she invited me to the Biennale that was happening that year in Sydney. And as we're taking the ferry over, we're having a drink on the boat, and she's like, and I was kind of getting up the courage to ask her if I could call it like an artist in residency. Mm-hmm. And she's like, well, how about we'll call this your artist in residency, you know? And I'm like, oh my God, I was going to ask you the same thing.
Yeah.
And I was just so, it just was so in line with our rapport and felt just so right, like cosmically right. And it was such a great experience. I ended up getting to exhibit. She had a retrospective show because she'd had the studios for about 8 or 10 years before that, but she hadn't opened the gallery yet. And so she invited me into the retrospective shows. I made two two new big paintings for it. The residency culminated in this show that was the inaugural opening show for the gallery, which is called Scratch. And her and I are both painters, but we did this very, like, multimedia installation kind of thing. It was called Detour, and it's kind of like the loose idea was, you know, you're traveling, you have this like destination in mind, but inevitably you're always going to end up like having to pull off, take a different route, pull over, stop and think, etc. And it was kind of like that loose idea, but initially started, we wanted to get this grant and cut a car in half and have half of it in the gallery and half outside of the gallery. And it was in this suburb of Sydney called Merrickville. It's like, it's all industrial. It's kind of like dog patchy 10 years ago, like just a lot of warehouses and stuff like that. But she lived, like, Scratch was next door to this auto garage, and we were like, perfect, we can go talk to this dude. And this guy was pretty funny. Like, we went in there telling him what we want to do, and he's like, oh yeah, 110%, we can do this. And I'm like, he's making it sound like this is a little too easy, yeah. But just, and after he said 110%, like the fifth time, I was like, I can't wait to talk to Carmel about this guy, yeah. Saying 110% makes me not believe it. But yeah. Either way, we didn't get the grant, so we couldn't buy the car and pay him to cut it in half. So we were like, well, how are we going to do this on a budget? And then we just started, she had this idea to smash, like get Matchbox cars and smash them. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that is so fucked, Carmel, because that is what I did. This is one of my first memories, 4 years old. I had all these Matchbox cars, and I don't know where or why I did it, you know, like seeing on TV or something or whatever, but like I was putting them on the hearth of our fireplace and smashing them with a hammer. I just like the idea that it was taking different shapes. And
your parents probably like, you little shit.
My parents were sitting like 10 feet away the whole time I was doing this for probably 2 weeks. Yeah. And then one day they snap out of wherever they were at. They weren't like aloof parents, but I couldn't believe I was getting away with it for so long. But they're like, what are you doing? You're not getting any more Matchbox cars. Like, lesson learned there. But I thought it was just once again in line with the connection we had, just kind of filling each other's thoughts. And just, it was just wild because we'd only known each other for so long. But so that started it. So we did, I think there were 323 smashed Matchbox cars that we all bought and smashed, and then we hung them all from the ceiling in a corner of the gallery. And then we went to the junkyard and got all these like kind of auto parts, and we had the steering wheel that was hung with like fishing lines, so it looked like it was just floating in front of this like leather office chair. So it was like this Freudian kind of like suspended steering wheel that, you know, how does that work? Like, yeah. Where's that steering you? And I found all these little cogs, like these metal rusted cogs, and I made a compass that was like calibrated for the real direction. We got a compass out, so it was like really facing north, east, west. And we were painters trying to make like an aesthetic installation. Yeah. And then I collaborated with one of my old bandmates, and I had this idea from this Tom Waits skit where he's just kind of talking about cars that his uncle had and his aunt had, and it's just a Tom Waits story, so it's so rich and funny, yeah. And kind of great. You just want to listen to it over and over again. So I gave that to him, and he kind of created this like ambient landscape. It was like 15 minutes just taking little samples and putting delays on them, and just sounded so nice and soft. And so we had that playing in the background, and then I brought three typewriters there because I was really into typewriters for a long time. I was like, writing people's letters and playing Exquisite Corpse with them and stuff like that. But we had these typewriters that we built plinths and put them on top of these plinths, and had these questions regarding, I don't know, travel, like interpersonal relationships, but all kind of like this idea, like we're going this direction, like, and but what happens when this happens? And we encourage people to come up, type their answers, take the sheet out and just throw it on the floor to like be a little bit more loose, not make it so precious. So there's that. And then we drove around for like 12 hours just filming different. We went to some national parks and just went. I mean, it was just so awesome for me to drive around. And it's so pedestrian, like, you know, to just drive around and see what you'd see just driving around, say, in America. But I was in Australia, and it was just like, well, this is cool. So yeah, there was just so many different facets of this installation, but that was like what the residency culminated in. It opened, and then like the next day I moved to Melbourne because like I found out that I couldn't stay for 2 years, which I was planning to, and I could only stay for one, so I had to boot scoot down to Melbourne really quick so I could get my time in there. And I was down there for about 4 months, and Melbourne is such a potent place in terms of, like, creative people wanting to kind of, like, welcome you in and get you in, like, a little bit faster, I felt like, than it had happened in Sydney, as rich as that experience was. Mm. I met a bunch of artists, musicians down there right away, saw tons of shows, and then made some art and got to show in a couple group shows down there. And then, yeah, and then some friends came down and we bounced around, and it was great.
At that point, did you have a place here in San Francisco?
No, I had moved with, honestly, no intent to come back, but no hard, fast rule not to come back.
Yeah.
It was like, I'm leaving for now. But in a way, you're kind of like, well, I've already lived there. I should probably go live somewhere else.
Yeah.
At least that's how I was looking at it at the time. And then finished up in Australia, and my parents were living in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan at the time, which is just the middle of nowhere, beautiful, lots of trees, lots of oxygen, lakes. Not a lot of people, not exactly a lot of culture, but beautiful place to kind of recalibrate. But the dead of winter, it was pretty serious. But I also wanted to recalibrate, not, you know, move to a new city and come back sounding like an asshole, being my mates and with tons of Australia slang. And I was just in Australia. I was living in Australia. You don't want to do that. So, like, I'll go up there, get that all in my system. And I wanted to create a new body of work upon my return. The residency just really gave me so much confidence to pursue this idea of wanting to be a professional visual artist even more.
She recently visited you, yeah.
That's right.
You were able to.
That's right,
and
I, yeah. And she hasn't changed a bit, and I can't say how happy I was that I had the opportunity not to, like, just write her an email again, or, you know, because I always like to think that she knew how much it meant to me to have had that opportunity. But it was great to be able to say it in person and then show her all the work that I've been making in the interim. So yeah, spent 3 months, 4 months up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan making, I think I made 14 new paintings and 6 large drawings. Fortunately, mom and dad let me just eat their food, and I didn't have to, like, find a job or anything during the interim. And
how long were you there?
It's about 3 months, 3.5, almost 4, something like that. Fell in love with the girl at the dentist office, and then she, you know, she pulled the rug and said, you know, you're not sticking around.
Yeah.
And that's when I knew. I mean, the paintings were done, drawings were done. I was like, time. All right, this is, summer was coming, and I knew if I stayed for summer, I'd, who knows? Like, you know, you end up living in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan for the rest of your life by mistake. Somehow the idea of Portland, Oregon got into my brain, and a friend of mine who had been living in San Diego, California the whole time I'd been in San Francisco had moved back to Chicago temporarily, and he was going to move back to San Diego, and he's like, dude, how about you just drive with me across, and then you can just make your way up to Portland from there. I was like, that sounds great. And so that's exactly what I did, and I spent some time in San Diego, LA, and then San Francisco, kind of with the idea that maybe one of these places would pull me in and I'd be like, well, maybe I'll just park here. But none of them really did, and I ended up landing in Portland, Oregon on July 1st, on my birthday of 2013, and made a go of it. I mean, we'd been up there on tour a couple times with my old band. Seemed like a viable place where you could kind of maybe try to be a creative and link together all the gigs and commissions or whatever and just kind of make it happen, because rent was still kind of affordable at that point, and food is cheap up there. Everything is just a lot less than, say, New York, San Francisco, LA. Really, really cut my teeth. Totally ran out of all the money I had. Wasn't be able to stitch it together as much as I wanted. Ended up working at a law firm as an operator, paralegal, and it was just the most abject experience of my life. It's very cold and dark, and these are things that, you know, you hear about. It rains a lot, da 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 da. But it's also just very cold in this way that is bone chilling. After a while, you're like, well, I could persist. I could make, you know, you'd like to think you could make anything work. I can make this happen. But I was really missing the Bay so much, and my friends that were still living here, and just, I felt this wild magnetism return where I was like, man, I'd really like to go back. And, you know, it had changed so much because it had been away almost 3 years at that point. And people are like, dude, we can't wait to have you back, but this shit is not going to be easy for you.
Yeah.
Like, rents are out of this world now. It's just not the same. The city's changed. And I'm just like, I'm still going to do it. I'm going to figure out a way to do it. And after a couple false start to being like, okay, May 1st, okay, no, you know, June 1st, because you start talking to people where there's availabilities for rooms and you're not there. They're, you know, dangling carrots, and they're like, well, we found someone's here, you know. And they, of course, that makes sense. Ended up, I was like a Hail Mary. I was like, well, fine, I'm leaving on August 1st. I have to be there. So I was kind of looking at putting all my shit into storage and seeing what happened, sleeping on couches until I found something, which I knew was, you know, it's a little risky because you know, you might make an impulsive decision on where you're going to live, etc. And a friend of mine ended up, he's like, hey, listen, you know, don't hold your breath, but I talked to one of my coworkers and she needs a roommate. You should give her a call. And had this hour phone conversation with this girl, Berkeley, who's my current roommate. And at the end of it, she's like, do you want to move in? And I was just like, my God, like with a week to go. And somehow just like, yeah, seriously lucked out with a spot, with affordable rent and lovely roommates and in directly in the Mission, in the heart of the neighborhood that I lived in before.
Yeah.
And it was just, it felt like it couldn't have been more like...
Stars aligned.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. And that's the spot.
Absolutely.
That we're in now.
Yeah, yep.
And it's rent controlled.
It's rent controlled.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you have a full-time job again.
I have a full-time job again. I don't come from a long line of artists or anything like that. My parents are very traditional Midwest people. And I think they really ingrained that, you know, I mean, I've always been an artist, but I've also always loved having hot water and paying bills on time and being able to afford a new pair of socks if you need them or whatever. I've always just kind of came to terms with, it makes me more comfortable as someone who produces work. I can produce work a lot more fluidly or comfortably, knowing that I've got checks coming in and not having to crutch my livelihood on how well the art is in terms of being able to sell it. Mm. So yeah, always have done the dance of, you know, get up at an ungodly hour, come home way later than you want, but I think it creates a serious sense of discipline and time management that I wouldn't probably arrive to if I was in a different situation, because it just reminds you how much if you really want something, you have to work hard at it. Basically, most art forms are not cheap to do. You know, even you need a laptop, you need an expensive microphone, and that's kind of like a pretty small rig, you know, all of it. And you kind of need money to...
It's mostly my time.
It's time.
That's the most expensive part.
And you can't discount that. I think it's, for now, it really works. I mean, of course, there's an ideal to be able to not have to have that full-time job, but that's the moonshot, you know. There are very few people out there that have made that happen, but I've also been lucky enough to make some friends with them, and realize it is possible, but you still also have to work your ass off. You have to work harder than you thought you have to. That's pretty much, it's a constant hustle just to fit it all in.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but do you feel that also having a full-time job makes you more excited to work on your work? Whereas if you're doing it day in and day out, it might, maybe, I don't know. I'm sure it's different for everyone.
That is something I've talked to artists who do it full-time. And anyone who does anything full-time, whether it's making music, making films, writing a book, this creative endeavor is now your bread and butter.
Right.
And in a way, that is now work.
Yeah.
That is work. And you better fucking make it good, otherwise it's not going to pay the bills. Which adds a sense of maybe, you know, urgency and pressure and stress to it that it is definitely something I've considered. I've talked to a friend, he does very well. He's a painter, and well enough to probably support himself and his future wife. But he and I had the conversation. He's like, no, I will still have a full time job. He handles artwork at SF MoMA, and he's just like, no. I mean, it's nice because you have that steady paycheck coming in, and then anything you sell with artwork is almost like this total bonus, and because you love doing it anyway, but you're not stressing it. You don't have to worry about whether or not it's going to sell or not, like right away or when you need to get paid because you don't have any money.
Yeah, I think there's so many different ways you can approach it. I was listening to the audiobook of Your Money or Your Life, Choose Your Money or Change Your Money or Change Your Life, I think is what it's called.
Yeah.
It's like a 9-step thing that I kind of like spaced out for the actual steps because I'm like, I'm not going to do this. But the beginning part was interesting, and somewhere in the middle was interesting. She was talking about the different ways that you can long as you know like what your goals are, whether financial or lifestyle or whatever, maybe you like have a part-time job and do your art part-time, and like it's all about what works for you.
Absolutely. Right? And I think underlying all that is that you're happy.
Right.
As happy as you can be, because don't get me wrong, you can feel really stressed given whatever you're doing at your job, whatever it is, and then if you're really trying to push your artwork, whatever it might be, I always found it a little funny and frustrating when you tell people that you're an artist. And it took me a really long time, you know, when people are like, what do you do? And it took a long time for me to just say artist instead of, you know, well, I work at an architecture firm, but then I also play in a band, or, you know, like, it's just kind of this very awkward answer. And it took a while to just say it with confidence. I always, found it a little frustrating and funny when you tell a majority of people, if they're not a creative or if they're just kind of like a regular liver, as it were, their face just kind of stretches back and they're like, oh, that's so nice. That must be so much fun for you to do.
Yeah.
And in a way, you're like, no, I fucking cried in my studio last night because I couldn't figure out what color or mark this thing needed. And I was, you know, you really want to make something great. And it is not this walk in the park that I think a lot of people might misperceive it as. I mean, it totally represents that spectrum of emotion. Like, you can get pretty down about it, but then it can make you feel great like you've never felt before. I think that's why I love doing it, because there was no career that I could ever think of that would bring me that satisfaction that I could think of, that I've heard of, you know? So, yeah.
I think there's also like a funny false perception when someone says that they're an artist, which, like, I totally agree that is what an artist or musician or whatever should do in order to, like, really own it. But then once the other person finds out they're also, like, they also work at architecture firm or whatever, it's like, if they're not familiar with the concept of owning the thing that you want to do, they might be like, oh, well, they're just, like, pretending, you know, or they're, like, trying to put off a perception that they're doing this full-time when they're not.
Sure.
I feel like that's kind of common in places maybe outside of bigger cities and stuff where, I don't know. I feel like those people need to let that go, but I've seen it happen among my friends where someone's like, oh, they said they're an artist, but I later found out that they're, you know, they're like faking it, you know?
Right. And I see, well, I don't want to say it's like, because I always fucking hated that expression, fake it till you make it, or kind of faking anything, you know? It is our responsibility to be confident and have ownership of what we do. But you're not telling lies, you know? I mean, it's what you identify with. Right. And I think it's up to the person asking the questions and listening. There's a big part that, you know, they need to ask, well, so do you do that full time?
Right.
That's a pretty easy question to ask. And that's, you know, then you know who you're in conversation with. And if they just, I mean, if you're going to go run around, make presumptions about what someone said and not ask about it, that's, do it at your own peril.
Yeah, totally. But love to talk about some of the changes happening in the Bay Area a bit and how, if they've impacted you and how, and just your general perception.
So yeah, going back to when I was moving back, you know, everyone's like, it's changed. And I got back and you're like, oh yeah, I didn't notice that building there before. Or, you know, well, there's a lot more people wearing fleece zip-up vests and stuff like that. And because I was new and I kind of had that reprieve or that little sabbatical, it didn't feel like it wore on me. And I was trying to remind everybody, you know, like, everything changes. This is good. If it stayed the same, it wouldn't be as good. You have to have some modicum of change to keep things fresh and keep things moving. I did my best to really maintain that countenance for as long as I could before you're just like, shit. Yep, it's changed.
When your friends are leaving and stuff because they can't afford rent.
Absolutely.
Not to say that's happening.
People are leaving either the Bay Area fully, or they're just moving to Oakland or up north, or just trying to make it happen. And, you know, we're all getting older and people are taking different life paths, whatever they might be. And that, you know, and sensibilities change and all that stuff over the course of time. And that feels like a very literal change, along with the way the city's changing and the shape and the tech industry really settling here. I mean, it's always been here, but in the biggest way, it's now, this is the epicenter. Like, the world knows the Bay Area, Silicon Valley, as being just, that is where tech happens. That's where everyone's coming. Everyone's gravitating to if they want to do it. There's so many startups doing everything, which I kind of think is really funny. I think at some point I was like, so what's your startup about? So yeah, it was to check it out. So you come to our site and and you basically sign up and we'll find you a dog walker. We'll like set that up. I'm like, so it's like you guys are kind of doing like the Yellow Pages, like yeah. all over again. I mean, and
was it you who was talking about food delivery? Talking to food delivery about someone, and they're like, people in early 20s in tech don't realize it. Like food delivery has been around
it's
fucking
forever.
You'd always call it pizza
guy. Yeah, Chinese takeout or whatever.
They
yeah,
discovered food delivery. Yeah, they're yeah. Like, yeah.
And it starts to feel a little funny. So, but I mean, and that's, I think overall, we all do well to find humor in whatever we can.
Yeah.
Once you start taking everything so fucking seriously, it gets really depressing really fast. And
I just think there's some like serious consequences happening, right? Within that are maybe like outside of our bubbles, for like a better term, happening that has people concerned. Like people are more desperate. People are stuff like that.
Very much, very much so. I moved here in 2005, and San Francisco, San Diego, LA, there's always been a pretty, you know, Florida, there's always a pretty strong contingent of, you know, transient people, because you're not going to freeze to death.
Right.
You can sleep outside pretty much all year, and you'll be all right. And I don't know if it's a lack of the investment in social services or just, you know, because for as much money seems to be flowing through this entire city, the evidence of the people that have fallen behind have just grown exponentially. And it's just so much more visible. And it's very frustrating to that extent, because you're just like, why aren't there, you know, more shelters opening or services to address the situation? Because it is grown to like epidemic proportions. Unfortunately, it's really starting to get kind of a rough vibe. Like people come and visit San Francisco and they're like, I just stepped in human shit.
Yeah.
Like, and that is like what people say. Like when you're like, oh, I went to San Francisco, it was fucking filthy. And how is everyone so rich and wanting to do that here? There is just this kind of, yeah, it feels very, very much like a paradox. Like how is this, like, how does that work? And how do you go about addressing it? But I'll tell you what, Shannon, politics, they're not for me.
No.
I try to be as aware as I possibly can of them, but they ultimately just end up frustrating me.
And to go back to your sense of humor thing.
Yeah.
You just
gotta keep it as light as possible.
Yeah.
Kind of how I do. I can be a very naive and optimistic person on any given day, and then I can be very cynical and dark, and it's just running across the teeter-totter. If you feel like that shit's bouncing too far on one end, you better get your butt back up to the other end to keep it balanced.
What's something you're excited about today?
Well, I was really very much looking forward to this chat with you, Shannon. I think your project is so so timely and pertinent to what people are doing in a creative process, you
yeah.
know? I think it, when you're younger, I guess you don't think about process as much. You're like, I'm just painting, or I'm just writing songs. You don't really get down in this analytical mud and be like, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? Like asking all these kind of big questions about just the autonomy of the situation. But I think it's really important to dig in and ask people why. It's never been satisfactory when I ask someone, why are you making this? And they're just like, I don't know, I felt like it. And you're like, I need more. Tell me more. And if you don't have anything for me right now, I'm going to give you an assignment. Go home and think about it. And then let's meet up again. And I hope you can tell me about it. Because I think that's so important to have a self-awareness about your creative endeavors, your interpersonal relationships, how you're living life in general. Try to be as aware of everything as possible. Because a lot can get lost, especially when you're in the thick of it. It's hard to see the forest through the trees sometimes when you're pouring yourself into creativity. Unfortunately, yeah, you can just lose sight and forget to address other things, and it is a juggling act, but I think it's very important to not lose sight, to check in, ask questions to yourself, those around you, just to make sure that you're not losing the plot.
So, okay, this will be the last question. Why are you creating your art?
It gives me a serious reason to wake up in the morning. Hope is a fucked up word that I'm slowly learning more and more about, but you gotta have it.
Yeah.
Man's gotta have hope. woman's got to have hope. People got to have hope. You just got to have it. You got to find it. And the sense of purpose, I think, is really important too. I think, you know, if you don't have something that you're passionate about, personally speaking, I need it. I need to have this. Like, I kind of, it informs my identity so much. Yeah, I don't know what I would do without it. I don't know who I would be without it. And so I'm really glad it found me and I found it, or however that worked out.